response of police to anti-monarchy protesters amid a number of incidents, the latest of which included the arrest of a man in Edinburgh for apparently heckling Prince Andrew. The advocacy group Liberty said that new powers recently given to the police to curtail protests and how they were being enforced by police officers were a cause for deep concern. The Labour MP Zara Sultana said in response to incidents in Edinburgh, London and Oxford, "No one should be arrested for just expressing Republican views. Extraordinary and shocking that this needs saying." Police in Scotland said a 22-year-old man and a 52-year-old man had been arrested in connection with a breach of the peace on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh shortly before 3 p.m. local time on Monday, 12th of September. Earlier, a woman was charged after being arrested by police in Edinburgh on Sunday, 11th of September, as she staged a protest during the accession proclamation by the King. Police said the woman, a 22-year-old, had been arrested on Sunday outside St Giles' Cathedral in connection with a breach of the peace and would appear at Edinburgh Sheriff Court at a later date. The woman was seen holding a sign that said, "Abolish the monarchy." When she was arrested moments before the reading of the proclamation, the incident took place outside the cathedral where the Queen's coffin lay on Monday. In London, a barrister and a climate activist who had held up a blank piece of paper in Parliament Square said he had been threatened with arrest by a police officer under the Public Order Act. In November of 2021, ahead of the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, an Ipsos poll found that only 60% of the British public favoured the country remaining a monarchy, down from 76% 5 years ago. The Platinum Jubilee celebrations were countered by an international anti-monarchy conference which raised the slogan, "Make Elizabeth the Last."
On September 8, 2022, Queen Elizabeth II died at the age of 96. As her death prompted an outpouring of grief from her admirers, it also revived criticism of her legacy, bringing into relief the complex feelings of those who consider her as a symbol of the British colonial empire, an institution that enshrined itself through violence, theft, and oppression. Elizabeth II died less than a year after Barbados removed her as its head of state and became a republic, a move that partly stemmed from growing criticism of the British monarchy among Caribbean countries.
Presiding within the under English colonial rule, it becomes the laboratory for plantation societies in the Caribbean. It is in Barbados that English law, for the first time, knows a distinction in the racial status of subjects of the crown, in the sense that laws are passed which say essentially that people who are Negroes, and that word is borrowed from the Spanish, are fit for particular kinds of punitionary laws, as the text runs. So it is, Barbados does become the laboratory for a slave society, which is then exported to Jamaica in the 1650s and 60s, and to the Carolinas and then Georgia after that.
Others, including Jamaica, have hinted at declaring their independence too.
60 years of independence. We have not forgotten, and we demand an apology and reparation.
Our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Earlier in August, Senator Lydia Thorpe of Australia called Queen Elizabeth a colonizer during her swearing-in ceremony.
To the colonizing Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II.
Senator Thorpe. The start of Queen Elizabeth's reign in 1952 coincided with her government ordering the suppression of the Mau Mau independence uprising in Kenya.
We made the point repeatedly that it looked extremely immoral for Her Majesty's government, which is not contesting and has in fact admitted that atrocities were committed, torture was committed, that they have admitted. Now for them to continue relying on technicalities, being well aware that the majority of these victims are in the 80s, late 80s, that many of them live in squalid poverty, that many of them are not even able to afford health care in their old age. What could be more despicable? What could be more immoral than Her Majesty's government to continue as it were, to buy time, simply to wait for all these veterans to die one by one before tasting justice?
Much of the protesters were put in concentration camps and used as slave labor if they weren't murdered by British soldiers. Almost 1 year after the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, she oversaw one of the nastiest coup d'etats in modern history. Planned by Britain's MI6 and then executed by America's CIA, the coup overthrew Iran's democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh, paving the way for the tyrannical regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi that lasted for almost three decades and sowing distrust of the British among the Iranian nation. Elizabeth's reign was marked by rocky periods of irregular violence abroad, including Britain's ill-fated attempt to gain control of the Suez Canal in 1956 and the Falklands War, a 10-week-long battle with Argentina in 1982, in which the British responded to Buenos Aires' reclamation of territory with flames of war. Closer to home, the British Army waged its longest military campaign to date, Operation Banner, an effort to establish order during the Troubles, a bloody sectarian conflict that engulfed much of Northern Ireland between 1968 and 1998. British troops were given a green light to massacre 14 civilians in Northern Ireland on a protest march against Britain's policy of jailing Catholics without trial. The British establishment oversaw cover-up inquiries into what became known as Bloody Sunday. In the twilight years of the Queen's rule, her government invaded Iraq on the pretext of destroying non-existent weapons of mass destruction. During the long years of a joint British and U.S. occupation, it is likely that more than a million Iraqis died and millions more were driven from their homes. Over centuries, the UK has funneled trillions of dollars from its colonies to enrich itself. The monarchy was built on slavery. Establishing a slave trade that saw the transport of millions of Africans and South and North Americans to other countries. The slave trade was so vast, in fact, that it wasn't until 2015 that the country fully paid off its debts to slave owners from freeing slaves in the 19th century. Although Queen Elizabeth II did not herself enact these policies, her reign was a continuation of the earlier ones. Some historians believe she bears responsibility for all these atrocities. In the words of Harvard University history professor Maya Jasanoff, by design as much as by the accident of her long age, her presence as head of state and head of the Commonwealth, an association of Britain and its former colonies, put a stolid traditionalist front over decades of violent upheaval. As such, the Queen helped obscure a bloody history of decolonization whose proportions and legacies have yet to be adequately acknowledged. All in all, as Commander-in-Chief of the British Armed Forces, Queen Elizabeth oversaw a great number of wars and conflicts, including the Mau Mau Uprising in Kenya, the Jebel Akhdar War in Oman, the Cyprus Emergency, the Suez Crisis in Egypt, the Border Campaign in Ireland, the First Cod War in Iceland, the Upper Jaffa Disturbance in Yemen, the Dhofar Rebellion in Oman, the Indonesia-Malaysia confrontation in Borneo, the Aden emergency in Yemen, the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the Second Cod War in Iceland, the Third Cod War in Iceland, the Falklands War in Argentina, the multinational force in Lebanon, the Persian Gulf War in Iraq, the Bosnian War, Operation Desert Fox in Iraq, the Kosovo War, the Sierra Leone Civil War, the war in Afghanistan, the Iraq War, the First Libyan Civil War, Operation Shader in Iraq and Syria. Taraka Love, senior newsletter writer for New York Magazine, wrote, "For 96 years, that colonizer has been sucking up the Earth's resources. You can't be a literal oppressor and not expect the people you have oppressed not to rejoice on news of your death." Last but not least, the royal family's deep-seated racism appeared to persist even to the last days of the Queen. In 2020, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, left the royal family over racism within the family. Like all monarchs, Elizabeth was both an individual and an institution. As for her individual life, there is little information beyond her love of horses and dogs or a dysfunctional family. As an institution, not much to take pride in. A disappeared empire and a list of wars that claimed many innocent lives.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former US President Donald Trump hasn't been interviewed on Rupert Murdoch's Fox News for more than 100 days, and other Republicans often get the attention that Donald Trump once received. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled, Fox News, Once Home to Trump, Now Often Ignores Him. It has been more than 100 days since Donald Trump was interviewed on Fox News. The network, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch and boosted Mr. Trump's ascension from real estate developer and reality television star to the White House, is now often bypassing him in favor of showcasing other Republicans. In the former president's view, according to two people who have spoken to him recently, Fox News's ignoring him is an affront far worse than running stories and commentary that he has complained are too negative. The network is effectively displacing him from his favorite spot, the center of the news cycle. On 22nd of July, as Donald Trump was rallying supporters in Arizona and teasing the possibility of running for president in 2024, saying, "We may have to do it again," Fox News chose not to show the event. The same approach it has taken for nearly all of his rallies this year. Instead, the network aired Laura Ingraham's interview with a possible rival for the 2024 Republican nomination, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. It was the first of two primetime interviews that Fox News Channel aired with Ron DeSantis in the span of 5 days. He appeared on Tucker Carlson's show shortly after talking to Laura Ingraham. When Donald Trump spoke to a gathering of conservatives in Washington this week, Fox News did not air the speech. It instead showed a few clips after he was done speaking. That same day, it did broadcast live, for 17 minutes, a speech by former Vice President Mike Pence. Donald Trump has complained recently to aides that even Sean Hannity, his friend of 20 years, doesn't seem to be paying him much attention anymore, one person who spoke to him recalled. The snubs are not coincidental, according to several people close to Rupert Murdoch's Fox Corporation, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the company's operations. This month, the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal, both of them owned by Rupert Murdoch, published blistering editorials about Donald Trump's actions concerning the 6th of January 2021 riot on the Capitol. The skepticism towards Donald Trump extends to the highest levels of the company, according to two people with knowledge of the thinking of Rupert Murdoch, the chairman, and his son, Lachlan Murdoch, the chief executive. It also reflects concerns that Republicans in Washington, like Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, have expressed to the Murdochs about the potential harm that Donald Trump could cause to the Republican Party's chances in the upcoming elections, especially its odds of taking control of the Senate. The Murdochs' discomfort with Donald Trump stems from his refusal to accept his election loss, according to two people familiar with those conversations, and is generally in sync with the views of Republicans like Mitch McConnell, who mostly supported the former president, but long ago said the election was settled and condemned Donald Trump's efforts to overturn it. One person familiar with the Murdochs' thinking said they remained insistent that Fox News had made the right call when its decision desk projected that Joseph R. Biden would win Arizona just after 11 p.m. on the night of the election, a move that infuriated Donald Trump and short-circuited his attempt to prematurely declare victory. This person said Lachlan Murdoch had privately described the decision desk call, which came days before other networks concluded that Donald Trump had lost the state of Arizona, as something only that Fox had the courage and science to do. Some of the people acknowledged that Fox's current approach to Mr. Trump could be temporary. If Donald Trump announces he's running for president or he's indicted, he will warrant more coverage, they said. A spokesman for Mitch McConnell declined to comment. A spokesman for the Fox Corporation also declined to comment, as did a spokeswoman for Donald Trump. The relationship between Donald Trump and the Murdoch media empire has long been complicated. An arrangement of mutual convenience and mistrust that has had sensational ups and downs since Donald Trump first talked himself onto the gossip pages of the New York Post in the 1980s. But the spat between the former president and the media baron, who has helped set the Republican Party's agenda for decades, is occurring in a much larger and more fragmented media landscape, as new personalities and platforms make it much harder for any one outlet to change the narrative. Donald Trump's allies in the corners of the conservative media that are more loyal to him, including Breitbart, Newsmax and Talk Radio, are already seizing on the turn inside Fox News as evidence of a betrayal. Donald Trump appears willing to fight. He blasted Fox and Friends this week on his social media service, Truth Social, for being terrible and having gone to the dark side after one of his hosts had mentioned that Ron DeSantis had beat Donald Trump in two recent opinion polls of a hypothetical 2024 Republican primary contest. Then, offering no evidence, he blamed Paul Ryan, the former Republican Speaker of the House, with whom he often clashed. Paul Ryan sits on the Fox Corporation's board of directors. The New York Post was often on Mr. Trump's side in its editorials when he was president, but it occasionally went against him, like when Donald Trump refused to concede the election in 2020 and the paper's front page headlines blared, "Mr. President, stop this insanity." Donald Trump found a home on Fox News when the network's founder, Roger Ailes, gave him a weekly slot on Fox and Friends in 2011. Mr. Trump used the platform to connect with the budding Tea Party movement as he thrashed establishment Republicans like Paul Ryan and spread a lie about the authenticity of President Barack Obama's birth certificate. Initially, neither Roger Ailes nor Rupert Murdoch thought of Donald Trump as a serious presidential candidate. Roger Ailes told colleagues at the time that he thought Donald Trump was using his 2016 campaign to get a better deal with NBC, which broadcast The Apprentice, according to Insurgency, this reporter's account of Mr. Trump's rise in the GOP. And when Ivanka Trump told Rupert Murdoch over lunch in 2015 that her father intended to run for president, Rupert Murdoch reportedly did not even look up from his soup, according to The Devil's Bargain by Joshua Green. But as Mr. Trump became bigger than any one news outlet and bigger than even his own political party, he was able to turn the tables and rally his supporters against Fox News or any other outlet he felt was too critical of him. He regularly used Twitter to attack Fox personalities like Megyn Kelly, Charles Krauthammer and Karl Rove. The network could always be critical of him in its news coverage, But now the scepticism comes through louder. In asides from news anchors, in interviews with voters, or in opinion articles for other Murdoch-owned media properties. Referring to the congressional investigation into the 6th of January attack, the Fox anchor Brett Baier said it had made Donald Trump look horrific by detailing how it had taken 187 minutes for him to be persuaded to say anything publicly about the riot. One recent segment on FoxNews.com featured interviews with Trump supporters who were overwhelmingly unenthusiastic about a possible third campaign, saying that they thought his time has passed, and that he was a little too polarizing. Then they offered their thoughts on who should replace Donald Trump on the ticket. Unanimously, they named Ron DeSantis. I spent 11 years at Fox, and I know nothing pre-taped hits the Fox screen that hasn't been signed off on and sanctioned at the very top levels of management, said Eric Bolling, a former Fox News host who is now with Newsmax, especially when it has to do with a presidential election. There can be no denying that Fox News remains Fox News. Viewers in recent weeks have seen occasionally critical coverage of Donald Trump, but unlike other news networks, Fox has chosen to air its own primetime programming rather than the hearings of the committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, and Laura Ingraham dismissed the hearings as a show trial. They are lying, and we are not going to help them do it, Tucker Carlson has said. What we will do instead is to try to tell you the truth. The network has aired the January 6th committee hearings during the day, when far fewer viewers are tuning in. But other segments during the daytime and even evening play up violent crime in Democratic-run cities, or Joe Biden's verbal and physical stumbles. As the government announced that a key indicator of economic health declined last quarter, the headline Fox scrawled across the screen read, "Biden denies recession as U.S. enters recession." On 13th of April this year, Donald Trump called into Sean Hannity's show and ran through a list of crises he claimed would not be happening had we won this election, which we did. He hasn't been interviewed on the Fox News network ever since.
Yani.
Bazaar.
No matter where you're from or who you are, one thing that brings people together is a good meal. Everyone has a favorite food. It's a great way to connect with others, experience culture, and explore new flavors. And the food industry caters to our tastes, which is the main driver for the expansion of this sector. The food industry is made up of a complex network of activities related to farming, production, supply, and a host of services and products. So it's no surprise that this sector also plays a significant role in the economic development of any nation. Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh. This week, we will venture through Iran's food industry while shining the spotlight on meat production. We will explore this industry's contributions to the national economy. We wanted to learn more about the journey meat products take to finally reach grocery store shelves and dinner tables. So to become more familiar with food production, we visited a meatpacking business on the outskirts of the capital, Tehran. This particular producer was established 15 years ago and has become a familiar name in the industry. The meatpacking market is composed of many sectors within the market. One of the primary concerns for any company packaging meat is the ability to deliver fresh products to consumers. This can happen in various ways and is heavily dependent on the type of meat that will be packaged. For example, this company has several production halls dedicated explicitly to particular activities, because not all meat comes in the same size or can be handled with the same machine. There are different production halls for each meat type. Red meats, such as lamb and cow, require larger machines and more space, while poultry, such as chicken, require smaller machines comprising closed-circuit production lines. But why does this company use a closed-circuit production line? This ensures the meat passing through each stage is kept cool and free of foreign contaminants. More importantly, such a process guarantees that each item is uniformly cut and packaged while maintaining sanitary conditions crucial for quality and safety. Now, the modern food industry uses a wide variety of sophisticated technologies, making production more efficient. It has also reduced menial human labor, freeing up hands for other, more complex tasks. In case you didn't know, and many don't, Iran has indigenized a lot of technology and machinery needed in the food industry. Moreover, these machines play a crucial role in maintaining food quality and safety. For most companies in the food industry, the high-quality output is deeply hinged on the raw material they use. In the case of this company, they use free-range livestock that is pasture-fed from some of the most famous animal-rearing regions of the country. While most meatpacking companies have their own slaughterhouses, this one maintains contracts with livestock farmers who slaughter the animals before sending them to the packing company. The food industry is one of the most heavily regulated sectors in the nation. That is because quality and safety are important aspects for consumers. This company makes its products along the lines of Iran's Food and Drug Administration guidelines and the National Standards Bureau. It has also received international certificates for production and safety, meaning it can easily export its products too. Additionally, this company has created numerous job opportunities for the community while maintaining the highest production standards. What makes a company stand out among others in this highly competitive industry is not only the quality of products, but also the services it provides to its consumers. While the food industry has not been directly sanctioned by the United States, these harsh measures have hindered international banking and money transfers. This means many in this sector cannot import important machine components, which are still not locally manufactured. The basis of the food industry has always been agricultural production. Without the output of this sector, the food industry would not thrive as it does now. That's why Iran has a very robust agrarian industry. But agriculture is not limited to farming alone. It also includes livestock rearing, dairy, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Plus, exports from this strategic industry have also generated millions in foreign revenues, contributing to the national economy. First, let's look at the country's meat production as a whole. Based on the National Livestock Exporters Assembly, domestic needs for red meat roughly stands at 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, the country had 72 million heads of these animals, meaning 12 million were surplus and could be used for various exports. According to official figures, this year, 51,000 tons of red meat were produced up to the month of May alone. However, not all livestock are raised for their meat. They are also used for dairy production. Looking at statistics from Iran's Customs Administration, roughly $800 million of raw milk is exported annually. Next, we have the agriculture sector, which mainly produces raw materials for other food production. Data from the Customs Administration shows that some 7 million tons of agricultural and food products were exported last year. This amount was worth nearly $5 billion and reveals an 8% growth in export values compared to 2020. Looking more closely at these exports, around half of this revenue was raked in by 10 major agricultural products. The undisputed king of all agricultural exports is saffron, which brought $1 billion in trade. Next came pistachios, valued at $540 million, followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of value. Following the success of the first industrial park in 1890, more of these parks began mushrooming all over the world. Industrial zones are viewed as an effective way of increasing synergies between industrial activities through sharing resources. Furthermore, they drive commerce and business for greater economic stability among global and domestic participants. These days, industrial parks are key engines for economic growth and financial security. We are going to explore Iran's industrial parks. We will examine why industrial parks and estates are so important to the national economy. To become more familiar with industrial parks, we visited one on the outskirts of the capital city of Tehran. It was originally launched roughly 3 decades ago and has since grown into one of the most densely packed industrial zones of the province. Spanning some 260 hectares of land, this establishment is home to hundreds of producers active in several production fields. So how does this establishment work, and what makes industrial parks attractive to businesses? One answer is that these zones offer unique services that support investors and companies. However, one of the most important advantages is the large plots of land fitted with the necessary infrastructure for production and distribution. Each year, thousands of tons of products are produced here. Industrial parks also provide vast amounts of space to store goods, and some have their own airports and ground terminals for cargo distribution. But that's not all. Many industrial parks are also situated in economic zones, which offer numerous benefits to businesses while cutting some of their development costs. Additionally, there are other advantages to operating in industrial zones for manufacturers who are also exporters. These include softer customs regulations and certain tax exemptions, among others. As a result, exports from these areas have also contributed millions of dollars to the national economy. Industrial zones are ideal catalysts for industrialization and economic development. They provide the infrastructure necessary for small and medium-sized enterprises to grow. These parks have emerged as the new super tonic for the unprecedented growth of urban business and commerce. But have you ever wondered how an industrial park is created? It's no easy task. Planning and launching one of these zones is considered an industry of its own. We caught up with a holding company specializing in planning and developing industrial parks in Tehran province. We wanted to see how these establishments are shaped, executed, and launched. It all starts with targeting the appropriate plot of land. This holding purchases the necessary land, which sometimes can cover hundreds of hectares. This entity carries out its activities under the National Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization. This organization is affiliated with the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade. So the holding links various industries with government executive branches and helps remove barriers for manufacturing units. Plus, it connects investors to businesses while handling some of the government's bureaucratic processes for national and international investors. One of the main goals of creating these parks is to support local production and increase exports. Doing so will save the country millions on importing similar goods that can be domestically produced. At its core, an industrial park is a portion of a city or land zoned for industrial use rather than residential or commercial needs. These places can be home to a host of industries and might have oil refineries, power plants, ports, and so much more. The parks serve another purpose too. They are also meant to protect the environment, as industrial parks collect factories and other manufacturing facilities in an area outside of town. Moreover, these zones foster technological learning and innovation while creating jobs. Plus, such sites provide intermediary support for institutions while promoting interdisciplinary networks. Their activities support market expansion and reach by providing services to companies that help businesses stay relevant in the competitive market. For instance, this holding company has sponsored various national and international exhibitions where companies in industrial zones can participate. They offer dozens of types of services to small and medium-sized businesses both inside industrial parks and outside these zones. It might be interesting to know that nearly every province of Iran has at least one of these holding companies that establishes industrial parks. For example, the holding company for Tehran province has already established numerous estates and sites over the years, but its activities haven't stopped there. As part of its future vision, this holding hopes to expand its activities, and one of its projects is launching more industrial parks focusing on knowledge-based production. Generally speaking, the number of industrial parks has increased by over 270-fold since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Presently, there are over 1,000 industrial parks and zones scattered across the country. Over 830 of this total has been handed over to industrial units. That's all based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. All things considered, Iran's industrial zones have a bright and promising future while offering lucrative investment opportunities with big profits. The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years.
Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the event. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services.
This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations.
All right, now is the time for me to take a little break here and give the floor to my good friend out in the field who has prepared a report for us.
What's going on, guys? Well, actually, it's been a while that I've been looking for a practical pair of shoes, and today I decided to come to the first and oldest industrial shoe producer in Iran and the biggest distributor in the Middle East. Looking around, I can see a wide range of shoes in different colors, and this is what makes it difficult for me to choose the right one. To be honest with you guys, I've always been excited to learn more about the manufacturing process of shoes. For this reason, I asked this company to walk me through the production line of footwear. So don't go anywhere, stay with me. I wanted to step right into the factory to see the production line, but I just realized that every little piece has a process here. Now I'm in the designing room, and there's the thing that is called the last of the shoes, and it was really interesting to me to see how the shoes that we wear on a day-to-day basis is turned from to this. Now I'm going to give you an overview of how it is turned into the shoes that we wear. There's tape that is applied on the last, and to draw the design and create the prototype for different collection of shoes. And then it is sent off to stitching section to cut out the pattern on the necessary materials. And we've got different materials, different leather materials with different patterns and different colors. And finally, after the whole thing is approved, it is sent off to the production line. Partly due to the number of pieces used to make one shoe, constructing footwear is a true craft. The pieces needed to make the shoe are cut from high-quality leather, then next in the shoe manufacturing process comes stamping. In the factory, there are various departments that each performs different stages of the production process. When a department has finished their role, the soles are forwarded to the next department in line. Right off from the designing section, they get into the production line, and all the pieces are die-cutted. They are cut into different pieces to finally send them for gluing and stitching to ensure all the pieces are stuck together. All right, now it's time to move to the final section.
We'll be right back.
Shoe manufacturing involves numerous steps to put all the pieces together. Assembling the shoe is the step into production where the magic happens. Here, all the pieces, including the one that was just sewn, are fitted to form finished shoes. During assembling, the upper is bonded to the outsole. But before this happens, the insole is attached to the last and the upper ridge is placed on the insole to allow the shaft to be stitched to the wet later on and finally give the shoe its final shape. It's simple. It is not as simple as you think. It is such a demanding job. I call this stage the birth of the shoes because the pairs of the shoes are taken off from the mold to finally move on to the final stage, which is trimming. I'm going to give him these shoes, and what he does is cutting out the edges of the shoes to be completely trimmed and sent to the other guy for buffing, waxing, and polishing off the shoes. And finally, they are nice and shiny, and they are ready to be boxed up and shipped out to customers all across the country. Well, what is so significant about this company is the durability and the guarantee of its shoes over time. So for this reason, I was so curious to see what the secret is behind this quality. Now, I'm in the quality control sector to see what happens exactly. All right, what happens here is after the shoes sampling are approved, they are sent off, like different parts of the shoes are sent off from the production sector to the quality control sector. And there are several machines that each of them does is dedicated to a specific style of shoes. For example, formal shoes, athletic shoes, children's shoes. But now, what is so exciting, I'm going to walk you through, or I'm going to draw your attention to the safety shoes. Can you ever imagine a 20 kilogram weight falling in a horrifying manner on your shoes? That is something beyond my imagination. So I want to tell you today that this is the machine. It is called the impact tester that does the same thing. So let's zoom in and see what happens exactly. But of course, it's super horrifying, so I need to keep my distance. Wow, what a sound. You see, it's really, it's like a horror movie, the sounds that I listen, that I hear in the movies. So you need to keep your distance. And since the front of the shoes needs to be fully backed for workers who have demanding jobs in harsh conditions, this machine was created to, form or place this mold in the front of the shoes to protect workers from any sort of damages. So this is really mind-boggling, and it's really a lot to get my mind around. By the end of the day, around 1,400 types of footwear are sold extensively in this company's chain stores. This wide range offers various styles for people of all ages in the society, such as men, women, kids, sports, and as I showed you earlier, safety shoes. After I took a real-life tour into the footwear production world, I gained a broader perspective on how a single pair of shoes is actually made. Wow, for me it was really amusing to take a look at the behind-the-scenes of shoemaking. And now that I have all those processes in mind, it's time to see if I can find a practical pair of shoes. Alright, now I realize that there are so many factors that play a significant role in choosing a standard pair of shoes, such as the raw material, the comfort, the beauty, the design, and the color. What I appreciate most about this company is the fact that it offers a constellation of footwear in various colors. Shoes for men, women, children, and even safety shoes, as I mentioned earlier. And we've got sandals, slippers, and of course, in different quality, we've got leather shoes, linen shoes, and just you name it. Among all of these footwear, I chose this one, which I really loved the way it looks and the color and of course the comfort. I gave it a try, and yeah, I'm going home with this pair of shoes. And finally, I found the one that I was looking for. I hope that you got a better understanding of what a pair of shoes goes for before it reaches into your hands. I've been Sarah Dema.
That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the years following the 11th of September 2001, anti-Muslim sentiments has grown in the United States. Studies showed from 2001 to 2009, hate crimes against Muslims in the United States increased by 500%. According to experts, former U.S. President Donald Trump's approach against Muslims is an example of an unprecedented anti-Islamic government in America. But what is currently worrying is that manifestation of Islamophobia has not decreased in the administration of current President Joe Biden. We will now take a look at the world media's coverage of this subject. Please stay with us. Al Jazeera's website writes, "The Muslim population of the United States has increasingly been the target of Islamophobia and hate crimes in the years following the suspicious 9/11 attacks, which unleashed a new era of racism and discrimination against Muslims. On the 21st anniversary of the attacks on Sunday, 11th of September, the executive director of the Los Angeles